He could stand it no longer. He jumped out and strode across the slippery square to another tram line, on which, by cheating, he could return to his own district on the same ticket. Good for one transfer, but not at all for a return journey. But the honest official calculation that a passenger would travel in one direction only was undermined in certain cases by the fact that, knowing the routes, one could turn a straight journey imperceptibly into an arc, bending back to the point of departure. This clever system, pleasant evidence of a certain purely German flaw in the planning of tram routes, was willingly followed by Fyodor. From absent-mindedness, however, from an incapacity to cherish a material advantage for any length of time, and already thinking of something else, he paid automatically for the new ticket he had intended to save on. And even then the cheat prospered. Even then, not he, but the city transport department proved to be out of pocket. And furthermore, for a much, much greater sum, the price of a Nord Express ticket, than could have been expected. Crossing the square and turning into a side street, he walked toward the tram stop through a small, at first glance, thicket of fir trees gathered here for sale on account of the approach of Christmas. They formed between them a kind of small avenue. Swinging his arms as he walked, he brushed his fingertips against the wet needles. But soon the tiny avenue broadened out. The sun burst forth, and he emerged onto a garden terrace where on the soft red sand one could make out the sigla of a summer day, the imprints of a dog's paws, the beaded tracks of a wagtail, the Dunlop stripe left by Tanya's bicycle, dividing into two waves at the turn, and a heel dent where, with a light, mute movement containing perhaps a quarter of a pirouette, she had slid off it to one side and started walking, keeping hold of the handlebars. An old wooden house in the so-called Abiatinius style, painted a pale green, with light-colored drain pipes, carved designs under the roof, and a high stone foundation, where in the gray putty one could fancy one saw the round pink cruppers of walled-up horses. A large, sturdy, and extraordinarily expensive house, with balconies on a level with the lime branches and verandas decorated with precious glass, sailed forward to meet him in a cloud of swallows with a full spread of awnings, its lightning conductor cleaving through the blue sky and the bright white clouds extending an endless embrace. Sitting on the stone steps of the foremost veranda, illuminated squarely by the sun, our father, obviously just back from a swim, turbaned in a shaggy towel so that one cannot see, and how one would like to, his dark crop streaked with gray and tapering to a peak on his forehead, mother, all in white, staring straight in front of her, and somehow so youthfully hugging her knees, next to her, Tanya, in an ample blouse, the end of her black braid lying on her collarbone, her smooth parting lowered, holding in her arms a fox terrier, whose mouth is creased in a wide smile from the heat. Higher up, Ivona Ivanovna, who for some reason has not come out, her features blurred, but her slim waist, her belt, and her watch chain clearly visible. To one side, lower down, reclining and resting his head in the lap of the round-faced girl, velvet neck ribbon, silk bows, who gave Tanya music lessons, his father's brother, a stout army doctor, a joker, and a very handsome man. Lower still, two sour little glowering schoolboys, Fyodor's cousins, one in a school cap, the other without, the one without to be killed 7 years later in the Battle of Melitopol. At the very bottom, on the sand, in exactly the same pose as his mother, Fyodor himself, as he was then, though he had changed little since that time, white teeth, black brows, short hair, wearing an open shirt. One forgot who had taken it, but this transient, faded, and generally insignificant, how many others and better were there, photograph, unsuitable even for copying, had alone been saved by a miracle and had become priceless, reaching Paris among his mother's belongings and brought by her to Berlin last Christmas. For now, choosing her son a present, she was guided not by what was most costly to get, but by what was most difficult to part with. She had come to him for 2 weeks after a 3-year separation, and in the first moment, when powdered to a deathly pallor, wearing black gloves and black stockings and an old sealskin coat thrown open, she had descended the iron steps of the coach, glancing with equal quickness first at him and then at what was underfoot, and the next moment, her face twisted with the pain of happiness, was clinging to him, blissfully moaning, kissing him anywhere, ear, neck. It had seemed to him that the beauty of which he had been so proud had faded. But as his vision adjusted itself to the twilight of the present, so different at first from the distantly receding light of memory, he again recognized in her everything that he had loved. The pure outline of her face narrowing down to the chin, the changeful play of those green, brown, yellow, entrancing eyes under their velvet brows, the long, light stance, the avidity with which she lit a cigarette in the taxi, the attention with which she suddenly looked, unblinded, therefore by the excitement of the meeting as any other would have been, at the grotesque scene noticed by both of them, an imperturbable motorcyclist carrying a bust of Wagner in his sidecar. And already by the time they were coming up to the house, the light of the past had overtaken the present, had soaked it to saturation point, and everything became the same as it had been in this very Berlin 3 years previously, as it had once been in Russia, as it had been and would be forever. A spare room was found at Frau Staboy's place, and there, on the first evening, an open dressing case, rings taken off and laid on the marble washstand, lying on the sofa and ever so quickly eating raisins, without which she could not pass a single day, she spoke of what she had constantly returned to for almost 9 years now, repeating over again, incoherently, gloomily, ashamedly, turning her eyes away, as if confessing to something secret and terrible, that she believed more and more that Fyodor's father was alive, that her mourning was ridiculous, that the vague news of his death had never been confirmed by anyone, that he was somewhere in Tibet, in China, in captivity, in prison, in some desperate quagmire of troubles and privations, that he was convalescing after some long, long illness. And suddenly, flinging open the door noisily, stamping on the step, he would enter. And to an even greater degree than before, these words made Fyodor feel both happier and more frightened. Accustomed willy-nilly to consider his father dead all these years, he sensed something grotesque in the possibility of his return. Was it admissible that life could perform not only miracles, but miracles necessarily deprived, otherwise they would be unbearable, of even the tiniest hint of the supernatural? The miracle of this return would consist in its earthly nature, in its compatibility with reason, in the swift introduction of an incredible event into the accepted and comprehensible linkage of ordinary days. But the more the necessity for such naturalness grew with the years, the more difficult it became for life to meet it. And now what frightened him was not simply the imagining of a ghost, but the imagining of one that would not be frightening. There were days when it seemed to Fyodor that suddenly on the street, in Berlin there are little cul-de-sacs where at dusk the soul seems to dissolve, he would be approached by an old man of 70, in fairy-tale rags, shrouded to the eyes and beard, who would wink and say, as he had once been wont to, "Hello, son." His father often appeared to him in dreams, as if just returned from some monstrous penal servitude, having experienced physical tortures which it was forbidden to mention, now changed into clean linen, it was impossible to think of the body underneath, and with a completely uncharacteristic expression of unpleasant, momentous sullenness, with a sweaty brow and slightly bared teeth, sitting at table in the circle of his hushed family. But when, overcoming his sensation of the spuriousness of the very style foisted on fate, he nevertheless forced himself to imagine the arrival of a live father, aged but undoubtedly his, and the most complete, most convincing possible explanation of his silent absence, he was seized not by happiness, but by a sickening terror, which, however, immediately disappeared and yielded to a feeling of satisfied harmony when he removed this meeting beyond the boundary of earthly life. But, on the other hand, It happens that over a long period you are promised a great success, in which from the very start you do not believe, so dissimilar is it from the rest of fate's offerings. And if from time to time you do think of it, then you do so, as it were, to indulge your fantasy. But when, at last, on a very ordinary day, with a west wind blowing, the news comes, simply, instantaneously, and decisively destroying any hope in it, then you are suddenly amazed to find that although you did not believe in it, you had been living with it all this time, not realizing the constant close presence of the dream, which had long since grown fat and independent, so that now you cannot get it out of your life without making a hole in that life. Thus had Fyodor, in spite of all logic, and not daring to envision its realization, lived with the familiar dream of his father's return, a dream which had mysteriously embellished his life and somehow lifted it above the level of surrounding lives, so that he could see all sorts of distant and interesting things. Just as, when a little boy, his father used to lift him by his elbows, thus enabling him to see what was interesting over a fence. After the first evening, when she had renewed her hope and become convinced that the same hope was alive in her son, Elizaveta Pavlovna no longer referred to it in words. But, as usual, it was taken for granted in all their conversations, especially since they did not converse much aloud. Frequently, after several minutes of animated silence, Fyodor would suddenly notice that the whole time they both knew very well what it was about, this double, almost subgraminal speech, which emerged as a single stream, as a word understood to both of them. And sometimes they would play like this, sitting side by side, and silently imagining to themselves that each was taking the same Lyshino walk. They went out of the park, took the path along the field. There was a river to the left behind the alders. Across the shady graveyard where sun-flecked crosses were measuring something terribly large with their arms, and where it was somehow awkward to pick the raspberries. Across the river, upwards again, through the wood, to another bend of the river, to the Pont des Vaches and farther, through the pines and along the Chemin du Pendu. Familiar nicknames, not grating to their Russian ears, but thought up when their grandfathers had been children. And suddenly, in the middle of this silent walk being performed by two minds, using, according to the rules of the game, the rate of a human footstep, although they could have flown over their whole domains in a single instant, both stopped and said where they had got to. And when it turned out, as it often did, that neither one had outpaced the other, having halted in the same coppice, the same smile flashed upon mother and son and shone through their common tear. Very soon they again got into their inner rhythm of intercourse, for there was little new that they did not know already from letters. She told him in great detail about the recent wedding of Tanya, who had now gone off to Belgium until January, with a husband still unknown to Fyodor, an agreeable, quiet, very polite, and completely unremarkable gentleman working in the field of radio. And that when they returned, she would move into a new flat with them in an enormous house near one of the Paris gates. She was glad to be leaving the small hotel with the steep, dark staircase where she had been living with Tanya in a tiny but many-cornered room, completely swallowed up by a mirror and visited by bedbugs of various caliber, from transparent pink baby ones to leathery brown fatties, which congregated first behind the wall calendar with a Russian landscape by Levitin on it, and then closer to the field of action, in the inside pocket of the torn wallpaper, directly above the double bed. But the pleasant prospect of a new home was not unmixed with dread. She had an antipathy to her son-in-law, and there was something forced in Tanya's brisk, showy happiness. "You see, he's not quite our set," she confessed, stressing this with a certain tightening of the jaws and a downward look. But that was not all. And anyway, Fyodor had already heard about that other man, whom Tanya loved but who did not love her. They went out quite often, As always, Elizaveta Pavlovna seemed to be looking for something, rapidly spanning the world with a skimming glance of her shimmery eyes. The German holiday proved wet. Puddles made the sidewalk seem full of holes. The Christmas tree lights burned dully in the windows, and here and there at street corners a commercial Santa Claus in a red storm coat and with hungry eyes was distributing handbills. In the windows of a department store, some villain had had the idea of setting up dummy skiers on artificial snow beneath the Star of Bethlehem. Once they saw a modest communist procession walking through the slush with wet flags, most of the marchers battered by life, some crook-backed, others lame or sickly, a lot of plain-looking women, and several sedate petty bourgeois. Fyodor and his mother went to have a look at the apartment house where the three of them had lived for 2 years. But the janitor had already changed. The former proprietor had died. Strange curtains hung in the familiar windows. And somehow there was nothing their hearts could recognize. They visited a cinema where a Russian film was being shown, which conveyed with particular brio the globules of sweat rolling down the glistening faces of the factory workers, while the factory owner smoked a cigar all the time. And, of course, he took her to see Madame Chernyshevsky. The introduction was not altogether a success. Madame Chernyshevsky met her guest with a doleful tenderness meant to show that the experience of grief had linked them long and closely. But Elizaveta Pavlovna was most of all interested in what the other woman thought of Fyodor's verses, and in why no one was writing about them. "May I embrace you before you go?" asked Madame Chernyshevsky, preparatorily rising on tiptoe. She was a head shorter than Elizaveta Pavlovna, who bent down toward her with an innocent and radiant smile which quite destroyed the meaning of the embrace. "It's all right. One must be brave," said the lady, letting them out onto the stairs and covering her chin with the end of the downy shawl in which she was wrapped. "One must be brave. I've learned to be so brave that I could give lessons in endurance. But I think you've also come well through this school." "You know," said Elizaveta Pavlovna, stepping lightly but cautiously down the stairs and not turning her lowered head toward her son, "I think I'll just buy cigarette papers and tobacco, otherwise it comes out so dear." And immediately she added in the same voice, "Goodness, how sorry I am for her." And indeed, it was impossible not to pity Madame Chernyshevsky. Her husband had been kept over 3 months already in an institute for the mentally ailing, in the semi-loony bin, as he himself playfully expressed it in moments of lucidity. As long ago as October, Fyodor had once visited him there. In the sensibly furnished ward sat a fatter, rosier, beautifully shaven, and completely insane Chernyshevsky, in rubber slippers and a waterproof cloak with a hood. "Why, are you dead?" was the first thing he asked, more discontent than surprised. In his capacity as chairman of the Society for Struggle with the Other World, he was continually devising methods to prevent permeation by ghosts. His doctor, employing a new system of logical connivance, did not oppose this. And now, probably on the basis of its non-conductive quality in another sphere, he was trying out rubber. But evidently the results achieved so far were mainly negative, since when Fyodor was about to take a chair for himself, which was standing to one side, Chernyshevsky said irritably, "Leave it alone. You see very well there are two sitting on it already." And this two, and the rustling cloak, which plashed up with every movement, and the wordless presence of the attendant, as if this had been a meeting in prison, and the whole of the patient's conversation, seemed to Fyodor an unbearable, caricatured vulgarization of that complex, transparent, and still noble, though half-insane state of mind, in which Chernyshevsky had so recently communicated with his lost son. With the broad comedy inflections he had formerly reserved for jokes, but which he now used in earnest, he launched into extensive lamentations, all for some reason in German, over the fact that people were wasting money to invent anti-aircraft guns and poison gases, and not caring at all about the conduct of another million times more important struggle. Fyodor had a healed-over scrape on the side of his temple. That morning he had knocked it against one of the ribs of a radiator in hastily recovering the top of a toothpaste tube which had rolled underneath it. Suddenly breaking off his speech, Chernyshevsky pointed squeamishly and anxiously at his temple. "Was haben Sie da?" he asked, with a grimace of pain, and then smiled unpleasantly, and growing more and more angry and agitated, began to say that you could not get by him. He had recognized right away, he said, a recent suicide. The attendant came up to Fyodor and asked him to leave, and walking through the funereally luxuriant garden, past unctuous beds in which base-toned dark crimson dahlias were blooming in blessed sleep and eternal repose, toward the bench where he was awaited by Madame Chernyshevsky, who never went into her husband, but spent whole days in the immediate vicinity of his quarters, preoccupied, brisk, always with packages. Walking over the variegated gravel between myrtle shrubs resembling furniture, and taking the visitors he passed for paranoiacs, troubled Fyodor kept pondering over the fact that the misfortune of the Chernyshevskys appeared to be a kind of mocking variation on the theme of his own hope-suffused grief. And only much later did he understand the full refinement of the corollary and all the irreproachable compositional balance with which these collateral sounds had been included in his own life. 3 days before his mother's departure, in a large hall which was well known to Berlin Russians and which belonged to a society of dentists, judging by the portraits of venerable tooth doctors that looked down from the walls, an open literary evening was held in which Fyodor Konstantinovich also took part. Few people had turned up, and it was cold. By the doors, the same 1,000 times seen representatives of the local Russian intelligentsia stood around smoking, and as usual, catching sight of some familiar, friendly face, Fyodor hurried toward it with sincere pleasure, only to have it replaced by boredom after the first burst of conversation. Elizaveta Pavlovna was joined in the first row by Madame Chernyshevsky, and from the fact that his mother occasionally turned her head this way and that while adjusting her hairdo from behind, Fyodor, hovering about the hall, concluded that she was little interested in the society of her neighbor. At last the program began. First to read was a name-writer who in his time had appeared in all the Russian reviews, a gray-haired, clean-shaven old man, rather resembling a hoopoe, with eyes which were too good-natured for literature. In a sensibly everyday kind of voice, he read a tale of Petersburg life on the eve of the Revolution, with an ether-sniffing vamp, chic spies, champagne, Rasputin, and apocalyptically apoplectic sunsets over the Neva. After him, a certain Kron, writing under the pseudonym of Rostislav Stranyi, Rostislav the Strange, gladdened us with a long story about a romantic adventure in the town of 100 eyes beneath skies unknown. For the sake of beauty, his epithets were placed after the nouns. His verbs had also flown off somewhere or other, and for some reason the word starozhka, warily, was repeated about a dozen times. She warily let fall a smile. The chestnuts broke warily into blossom. After the interval, poets came thick and fast. A tall youth with a button-like face, another, shortish but with a large nose, an elderly lady wearing pince-nez, another younger one, and finally Koncheyev, who, in contrast to the triumphant precision and polish of the others, muttered his verses in a low, tired voice. But there dwelt independently in them such music, in the seemingly dark verse such a chasm of meaning yawned at one's feet, so convincing were the sounds, and so unexpectedly out of the very same words every poet was stringing together, there sprang up, played, and slipped away without ever quenching one's thirst, a unique perfection, bearing no resemblance to words, and in no need of words, that for the first time that evening the applause was not feigned. Last to appear was Godunov Chedintsev. From the poems written during the summer, He read those which Elizaveta Pavlovna liked so much, on Russia, the yellow birches mute in the blue sky, and on Berlin, beginning with the stanza, "Things here are in a sorry state. Even the moon is much too rough, though it is rumored to come straight from Hamburg where they make the stuff." And the one which moved her most of all, although she did not think to connect it with the memory of a young woman long dead whom Fyodor had loved when 16. "One night between sunset and river on the old bridge we stood, you and I. Will you ever forget it?" I queried. "That particular swift that went by?" And you answered so earnestly, "Never." And what sobs made us suddenly shiver, what a cry life emitted in flight. "Till we die, till tomorrow, forever, you and I on the old bridge one night." But it was getting late. Many people were moving toward the exit. One lady was putting on her coat with her back to the platform. The applause was sparse. The damp night gleamed black on the street with a raging wind. Never, never will we reach home. But nonetheless, a tram came, and hanging on a strap in the gangway over his mother sitting by the window, Fyodor thought with heavy revulsion of the verses he had written that day, of word fissures, of the leakage of poetry, and at the same time, with proud, joyous energy, with passionate impatience, he was already looking for the creation of something new, something still unknown, genuine, corresponding fully to the gift which he felt like a burden inside himself. On the eve of her departure, they both sat up late in his room, she in the armchair, easily and skillfully, whereas formerly she could not sew a button on, darning and mending his pitiful things, while he on the sofa, biting his nails, was reading a thick, battered book. Earlier in his youth, he had skipped some of the pages. Angelo, Journey to Arzrum. But lately it was precisely in these that he had found particular pleasure. He had only just got to the words, "The frontier held something mysterious for me. To travel had been my favorite dream since childhood," when suddenly he felt a sweet, strong stab from somewhere. Still not understanding, he put the book to one side and slipped blind fingers into a box full of homemade cigarettes. At that moment his mother said, without raising her head, "What did I just remember? Those funny rhymes about butterflies and moths which you and he composed together when we were out walking, you remember? Your blue stripe, catocalid, shows from under its gray lid." "Yes," replied Fyodor, "some were downright epics. A dead leaf is not hoarier than a newborn arborea." What a surprise it had been. Father had only just brought back the very first specimen from his travels, having found it during the initial trek through Siberia. He had not even had time to describe it yet. And on the first day after his return in the Lishino Park, 2 paces from the house, with no thought of Lepidoptera, while strolling with his wife and children, throwing a tennis ball for the fox terriers, basking in his return, in the balmy weather and the health and gaiety of his family, but unconsciously noting with the experienced eye of a hunter every insect along his path, he had suddenly pointed out to Fyodor with the tip of his cane a plump, reddish-gray Epicnaptera moth, with sinuate margins, of the leaf-mimicking kind, hanging asleep from a stalk under a bush. He had been about to walk on, the members of this genus look very much alike, but then squatted down, wrinkled his forehead, inspected his find, and suddenly said in a bright voice, "Well, I'm damned. I need not have gone so far." "I always said so," interposed his wife with a laugh. The furry little monster in his hand belonged to the new species he had just brought back, and now it had cropped up here in the province of St. Petersburg, whose fauna had been so well investigated. But as often happens, the momentum of mighty coincidence did not stop there. It was good for one more stage. Only a few days later, His father learned that this new moth had just been described from St. Petersburg specimens by a fellow scientist, and Fyodor cried all night long. They had beaten father to it. And now Yelizaveta Pavlovna was about to return to Paris. They stood for a long time on the narrow platform waiting for the train next to the luggage elevator, while on the other lines the sad city trains stopped for a moment, hastily banging their doors. The Paris Express rushed in. His mother boarded and immediately thrust her head through the window, smiling. By the neighboring opulent sleeping car, seeing off an unpretentious old lady, stood a couple, a pale red-lipped beauty in a black silk coat with a high fur collar, and a famous stunt flyer. Everyone was staring at him, at his muffler, at his back, as if expecting to find wings on it. "I have a suggestion to make," said his mother gaily as they parted. "I have about 70 marks left, which are quite useless to me, and you must eat better. I can't look at you, you're so thin. Here, take them." "Avec joie," he replied, instantly envisioning a year's pass to the state library, milk chocolate, and some mercenary young German girl, whom in his baser moments he kept planning to get for himself. Pensive, abstracted, vaguely tormented by the thought that somehow in his talks with his mother he had left the main thing untold, Fyodor returned home, took off his shoes, broke off the corner of a chocolate bar together with its silver paper, moved the book left open on the sofa closer. The harvest rippled, awaiting the sickle. Again that divine stab. And how it called, how it prompted him, the sentence about the Kerek. In faith the river was awesome. Or, even more fitly, more intimately, about the Tatar women. They were sitting on horseback, swathed in yashmaks. All one could see were their eyes and the heels of their shoes. Thus did he hearken to the purest sound from Pushkin's tuning fork, and he already knew exactly what this sound required of him. 2 weeks after his mother's departure, he wrote her about what he had conceived, what he had been helped to conceive by the transparent rhythm of Arzurum, and she replied as if she had already known about it, "It is a long time since I've been as happy as I was with you in Berlin, but watch out. This is no easy undertaking. I feel in my heart that you will accomplish it wonderfully, but remember that you need a great deal of exact information and very little family sentimentality. If you need anything, I'll tell you all I can, but take care of the special research where you are. And this is most important. Take all his books, and those of Grigory Yefimovich, and those of the Grand Duke, and lots more. Of course, you know how to obtain all this. And be sure to get into touch with Vasily Germanovich Kruger. Search him out if he's still in Berlin. They once traveled together, I remember. And approach other people. You know whom better than I. Write to Avinov, to Verity. Write to that German who used to visit us before the war. Banhas. Write to Stuttgart, to London, to Tring in Oxford. Everywhere. Débrouille-toi, because I know nothing of these matters, and all these names merely sing in my ears. But how certain I am that you will manage, my darling." He continued, however, to wait. The planned work was a wafture of bliss, and he was afraid to spoil that bliss by haste. And moreover, the complex responsibility of the work frightened him. He was not ready for it yet. Continuing his training program during the whole of spring, he fed on Pushkin, inhaled Pushkin. The reader of Pushkin has the capacity of his lungs enlarged. He studied the accuracy of the words and the absolute purity of their conjunction. He carried the transparency of prose to the limits of blank verse and then mastered it. In this he was served by a living example in the prose of Pushkin's History of the Pugachev Rebellion. "God help us not to see a Russian riot, senseless and merciless." To strengthen the muscles of his muse, he took on his rambles whole pages of Pugachev learned by heart, as a man using an iron bar instead of a walking stick. Toward him, out of a Pushkin tale, came Carolina Schmidt, a girl heavily rouged, of meek and modest appearance, who acquired the bed in which Schoening died. Beyond Grunewald Forest, a postmaster who resembled Simeon Virin, from another tale, was lighting his pipe by the window. There also stood pots with balsam flowers. The sky-blue sarafan of the damsel-turned peasant could be glimpsed among the alder bushes. He was in that state of feeling and mind when reality, giving way to fancies, blends with them in the nebulous visions of first sleep. Pushkin entered his blood. With Pushkin's voice merged the voice of his father. He kissed Pushkin's hot little hand, taking it for another large hand, smelling of the breakfast kalach, a blonde roll. He remembered that his and Tanya's nurse hailed from the same place that Pushkin's Arina came from, namely Suida, just beyond Gatchina. This had been within an hour's ride of their area, and she had also spoken sing-song-like. He heard his father on a fresh summer morning, as they walked down to the river bathhouse on whose plank wall shimmered the golden reflection of the water, repeating with classic fervor what he considered to be the most beautiful, not only of Pushkin's lines, but of all the verses ever written in the world. Tut Apollon ideal, tam Niabea pechal. Here is Apollo ideal, there is Niobe grief. And the russet wing and mother-of-pearl of a Niobe fritillary flashed over the scabiosus of the riverside meadow, where during the first days of June there occurred sparsely the small black Apollo. Indefatigably, in ecstasy, he was really preparing his work now. In Berlin, with an adjustment of 13 days, it was also the first days of June. Collected material, read until dawn, studied maps, wrote letters, and met with the necessary people. From Pushkin's prose he had passed to his life, so that in the beginning the rhythm of Pushkin's era commingled with the rhythm of his father's life. Scientific books, with the Berlin Library stamp always on the 99th page, such as the familiar volumes of The Travels of a Naturalist in unfamiliar black and green bindings, lay side by side with the old Russian journals in which he sought Pushkin's reflected light. There, one day, he stumbled over the remarkable Memoirs of the Past of A.N. Shuhashchokov, in which there were, among other things, two or three pages concerning his grandfather, Kirill Ilyich. His father had once referred to them with displeasure. And the fact that the writer of these memoirs mentioned him incidentally in connection with his thoughts on Pushkin now seemed somewhat to have particular significance. Even though he portrayed Kirill Ilyich as a gay dog and a good-for-nothing. Shuhashchokov wrote, "They say that a man whose leg is cut off at the hip can feel it for a long time, moving non-existent toes and flexing non-existent muscles. Thus will Russia long continue to feel the living presence of Pushkin. There is something seductive, like an abyss, in his fatal destiny. And indeed, he himself felt that he had had and would have a special reckoning with fate. In addition to the poets extracting poetry out of his past, he also found it in tragic thoughts about the future. The triple formula of human existence, irrevocability, unrealizability, inevitability, was well known to him. But how he wanted to live. In the above-mentioned album of my academic aunt, he personally wrote a poem which I can remember to this day, both mentally and visually, so that I can even see its position on the page. Oh no, my life has not grown tedious. I want it still, I love it still. My soul, although its youth has vanished, has not become completely chill. Fate will yet comfort me. A novel of genius I shall yet enjoy. I'll see yet a mature Mickiewicz with something I myself may toy." I do not think one could find any other poet who peered so often, now in jest, now superstitiously, or with inspired seriousness, into the future. Right to this day, there lives in the province of Kursk, topping the 100 mark, an old man whom I remember as being already elderly, stupid, and malicious. But Pushkin is no longer with us. Meeting in the course of my long life with remarkable talents and living through remarkable events, I've often meditated on how he would have reacted to this and that. Why, he could have seen the Emancipation of the Serfs and could have read Anna Karenina. Returning now to these reveries of mine, I recall that once in my youth I had something in the nature of a vision. This psychological episode is closely linked with the recollection of a personage still thriving to this very day, whom I shall call Ch. I trust he will not blame me for this revival of a distant past. We were acquainted through our families. My grandfather had once been friendly with his father. In 1836, while abroad, this Ch, who was then quite young, barely 17, quarreled with his family, and in so doing hastened, so they say, the decease of his sire, a hero of the Napoleonic War, and, in the company of some Hamburg merchants, sailed nonchalantly off to Boston, from there landing in Texas, where he successfully took up cattle breeding. In that manner, 20 years passed. The fortune he had made, he lost playing écarté on a Mississippi keelboat, won it back in the gaming houses of New Orleans, blued it all over again, and after one of those scandalously prolonged, noisy, smoky duels on closed premises, which were then fashionable in Louisiana, and after many other adventures, he became homesick for Russia, where, conveniently, a demesne was awaiting him, and with the same carefree easiness with which he had left it, he returned to Europe. Once, on a winter's day in 1858, he visited us unexpectedly at our house on the Moika in St. Petersburg. Father was away, and the guest was received by us youngsters. As we looked at this outlandish fop in his soft black hat and black clothes, the romantic gloom of which caused his silk shirt with its sumptuous pleats and his blue, lilac, and pink waistcoat with diamond buttons to stand out particularly dazzlingly, my brother and I could hardly contain our laughter, and decided there and then to take advantage of the fact that during all these years he had heard absolutely nothing of his homeland, as if it had fallen through some trapdoor, so that now, like a 40-year-old Repman Winkle waking up in a transformed St. Petersburg, Ch was hungry for any news, the which we undertook to give him plenty of, mixed with our outrageous fabrications. To the question, for instance, was Pushkin alive and what was he writing, I blasphemously replied, "Why, he came out with a new poem the other day." That night we took our guest to the theater. It did not turn out too well, however. Instead of treating him to a new Russian comedy, we showed him Othello with the famous black tragedian Aldrich. At first, our American planter seemed to be highly amused by the appearance of a genuine Negro on the stage. But he remained indifferent to the marvelous power of his acting and was more taken up with examining the audience, especially our St. Petersburg ladies, one of whom he soon afterwards married, who were devoured at that moment with envy for Desdemona. "Look who's sitting next to us," my brother suddenly said to Ch in a low voice. "There, to our right." In the neighboring box there sat an old man, of shortish stature, in a worn tailcoat, with a sallow and swarthy complexion, disheveled ashen side whiskers, and sparse, gray-streaked, tousled hair. He was taking a most eccentric delight in the acting of the African. His thick lips twitched, his nostrils were dilated, and at certain bits he even jumped up and down in his seat and banged with delight on the parapet, his rings flashing. "Well, who's that?" asked Chir. "What? Don't you recognize him? Look closer." "I don't recognize him." Then my brother made big eyes and whispered, "Why, that's Pushkin." Ch looked again, and after a minute became interested by something else. It seems funny now to recall what a strange mood came upon me then. The prank, as happens from time to time, rebounded, and this frivolously summoned ghost did not want to disappear. I was quite incapable of tearing myself away from the neighboring box. I looked at those harsh wrinkles, that broad nose, those large ears. Shivers ran down my back, and not all of Othello's jealousy was able to drag me away. What if this is indeed Pushkin, I mused. Pushkin at 60. Pushkin spared 2 decades ago by the bullet of the fatal coxcomb. Pushkin in the rich autumn of his genius. This is he, this yellow hand, grasping those ladies' opera glasses, wrote Anchar, Graf Nulin, the Egyptian Nights. The act finished. Applause thundered. Gray-haired Pushkin stood up abruptly, and still smiling with a bright sparkle in his youthful eyes, quickly left his box. So Khrushchev errs in depicting my grandfather as an empty-headed rake. It was simply that the latter's interests were situated on a different plane from the intellectual habitus of the young dilettante, member of the St. Petersburg literary set which our memoirist was then. Even if Kirill Ilyich had been pretty wild in his youth, once married, he not only settled down, but also entered government service, simultaneously doubling his inherited fortune by successful operations, and later retiring to his country place, where he manifested extraordinary skill in farming, produced a new sort of apple on the side, left a curious discours, the fruit of winter leisure, on the equality before the law in the animal kingdom, plus a proposal for a clever reform under the kind of intricate title that was fashionable then, Visions of an Egyptian Bureaucrat, and as an old man accepted an important consular post in London. He was kind, brave, and truthful, and had his quirks and passions. What more could be needed? A tradition has subsisted in the family that, having sworn not to game, he was physically incapable of remaining in a room where there was a pack of cards. An ancient Colt revolver that had served him well and a medallion with the portrait of a mysterious lady attracted indescribably my boyhood dreams. His life, which had retained to the end the freshness of its stormy beginning, ended peacefully. He returned to Russia in 1883, no longer a Louisiana dualist, but a Russian dignitary, and on a July day, on the leather sofa in the little blue corner room where I later kept my collection of butterflies, he expired without suffering, talking all the while in his deathbed delirium about a big river and the music and lights. My father was born in 1860. A love of Lepidoptera was inculcated into him by his German tutor. By the way, what has happened to those originals who used to teach natural history to Russian children? Green net, tin box on a sling, hat stuck with pinned butterflies, long, learned nose, candid eyes behind spectacles. Where are they all? Where are their frail skeletons? Or was this a special breed of Germans for export to Russia? Or am I not looking properly? After completing early, in 1876, his schooling in St. Petersburg, he received his university education in England at Cambridge, where he studied biology under Professor Bright. His first journey around the world he made while my grandfather was still alive, and from then until 1918 his whole life consisted of traveling and the writing of scientific works. The main ones among them are Lepidoptera Asiatica, 8 volumes published in parts from 1890 to 1917, The Butterflies and Moths of the Russian Empire, the first 4 out of 6 proposed volumes came out 1912 to 1916, and best known to the general public, The Travels of a Naturalist, 7 volumes, 1892 to 1912. These works were unanimously recognized as classics, and he was still a young man when his name occupied one of the first places in the study of the Russo-Asiatic fauna, side by side with the names of its pioneers, Fischer von Waldheim, Menetriès, Eversmann. He worked in close touch with his remarkable Russian contemporaries. Holodkovsky calls him the conquistador of Russian entomology. He collaborated with Charles Obertur, Grand Duke Nikolai Mikhailovich, Leitch, and Seitz. Scattered throughout entomological journals are hundreds of his papers, of which the first, On the Peculiarities of the Occurrence of Certain Butterflies in the Province of St. Petersburg, Horae Societatis Entomologici, Ross, is dated 1877, and the last, Ostorcia simonoides, new species, a geometrid moth mimicking a small Parnassus, Transactions Entomological Society, London, is dated 1916. He conducted a weighty and acrimonious polemic with Staudinger, author of the notorious Katalog. He was vice president of the Russian Entomological Society, full member of the Moscow Society of Investigators of Nature, member of the Imperial Russian Geographical Society, and honorary member of a multitude of learned societies abroad. Between 1885 and 1918, he covered an incredible amount of territory, making surveys of his route on a 3-mile scale for a distance of many thousands of miles and forming astounding collections. During these years, he completed 8 major expeditions, which in all lasted 18 years. But between them, there was also a multitude of minor journeys, diversions, as he called them, considering as part of these minutiae not only his trips to the less well-investigated countries of Europe, but also the journey around the world he had made in his youth. Tackling Asia in earnest, he investigated eastern Siberia, Altai, Fergana, the Pamirs, western China, the islands of the Gobi Sea and its coasts, Mongolia, and the incorrigible continent of Tibet, and described his travels in precise, weighty words. Such is the general scheme of my father's life, copied out of an encyclopedia. It still does not sing, but I can already hear a living voice within it. It remains to be said that in 1898, at 38 years of age, he married Yelizaveta Pavlovna Vyezhin, the 20-year-old daughter of a well-known statesman, that he had 2 children by her, that in the intervals between his journeys, an agonizing, somehow sacrilegious question, hardly expressible in words. Was her life with him happy, together and apart? Shall we disturb this inner world, or shall we limit ourselves to a mere description of roots? Arida quidam vierum descripto. Dear Mama, I now have a great favor to ask of you. Today is the 8th of July, his birthday. On any other day, I could never bring myself to ask you. Tell me something about you and him. Not the sort of thing I can find in our shared memories, but the sort of thing you alone have gone through and preserved. And here is part of the reply. Imagine a honeymoon trip, the Pyrenees, the divine bliss of everything, of the sun, the brooks, the flowers, the snowy summits, even the flies in the hotels, and of being every moment together. And then, one morning, I had a headache or something, or the heat was too much for me. He said he would go for a half-hour stroll before lunch. With odd clearness, I remember sitting on a hotel balcony. Around me, peace, the mountains, the wonderful cliffs of Gavarnie, and reading for the first time a book not intended for young girls, Une Vie by Maupassant. I remember I liked it very much at the time. I look at my little watch and I see that it is already lunchtime. More than an hour has passed since he left. I wait. At first I am a little cross, then I begin to worry. Lunch is served on the terrace, and I am unable to eat. I go out onto the lawn in front of the hotel. I return to my room. I go outside again. In another hour, I was in an indescribable state of terror, agitation, God knows what. I was traveling for the first time. I was inexperienced and easily frightened. And then there was une vie. I decided that he had abandoned me. The most stupid and terrible thoughts kept getting into my head. The day was passing. It seemed to me that the servants were gloating at me. Oh, I cannot convey to you what it was like. I had even begun to thrust some dresses into a suitcase in order to return immediately to Russia. And then I suddenly decided he was dead. I ran out and began to babble something crazy and to send for the police. Suddenly, I saw him walking across the lawn, his face more cheerful than I'd ever seen it before, although he'd been cheerful the whole time. There he came, waving his hand to me as if nothing had happened, and his light trousers had wet green spots on them. His panama had gone, his jacket was torn on one side. I expect you've already guessed what had happened. Thank God, at least, that he finally caught it after all, in his handkerchief on a sheer cliff. If not, he would have spent the night in the mountains, as he coolly explained to me. But now I want to tell you about something else from a slightly later period, when I already knew what a really good separation could be. You were quite small then, coming up to 3, you can't remember. That spring he went off to Tashkent. From there he was due to set off on a journey on the 1st of June, and to be away for not less than 2 years. That was already the second big absence during our time together. I often think now that if all the years he spent without me from the day of our wedding were added together, they would amount in all to no more than his present absence. And I also think of the fact that it sometimes seemed to me then that I was unhappy, but now I know that I was always happy, that that unhappiness was one of the colors of happiness. In short, I don't know what came over me that spring. I'd always been sort of batty when he went away, but that time I was quite disgracefully so. I suddenly decided that I would catch up with him and travel with him at least till autumn. Secretly, I gathered 1,000 things together. I had absolutely no idea what was needed, but it seemed to me that I was stocking up everything well and properly. I remember binoculars and an alpenstock and a camp bed and a sun helmet and a hairskin coat straight out of the captain's daughter and a little mother-of-pearl revolver and some great tarpaulin affair that I was afraid of, and a complicated water bottle that I couldn't unscrew. In short, think of the equipment of Tartarin de Tarascon. How I managed to leave you little ones, how I said goodbye to you, that's in a kind of mist. And I don't remember any more how I slipped out from Uncle Alec's surveillance, how I got to the station. But I was both frightened and cheerful. I felt myself a heroine. And on the stations, everyone looked at my English traveling costume with its short, entendons-nous, to the ankle, checked skirt, with the binoculars over one shoulder and a kind of purse over the other. That's how I looked when I jumped out of the tarantass in a settlement just outside of Tashkent, when in the brilliant sunlight, I shall never forget it, I caught sight of your father within 100 yards of the road. He was standing with one foot resting on a white stone, one elbow on a fence, and talking to 2 Cossacks. I ran across the gravel, shouting and laughing. He turned slowly, and when I suddenly stopped in front of him like a fool, he looked me all over, slit his eyes, and in a horribly unexpected voice spoke 3 words. "You go home." And I immediately turned and went back to my carriage and got in it, and saw he had put his foot in exactly the same place and had again propped his elbow, continuing his conversation with the Cossacks. And now I was driving back, in a trance, petrified, and only somewhere deep within me preparations had started for a storm of tears. But then, after a couple of miles, and here a smile broke through the written line, he overtook me in a cloud of dust on a white horse, and we parted this time quite differently, so that I resumed my way to St. Petersburg almost as cheerfully as I had left it. Only that I kept worrying about you too, wondering how you were. But no matter, you were in good health. Now, sometimes it seems to me that I do remember all this, perhaps because it was subsequently often mentioned. In general, our whole daily life was permeated with stories about Father, with worry about him, expectations of his return, the hidden sorrow of farewells, and the wild joy of welcomings. His passion was reflected in all of us, colored in different ways. apprehended in different ways, but permanent and habitual. His home museum, in which stood rows of oak cabinets with glass drawers full of crucified butterflies, the rest, the plants, beetles, birds, rodents, and reptiles he gave to his colleagues to study, where it smelled as it probably smells in paradise, and where the laboratory assistants worked at tables along the one-piece windows, was a kind of mysterious central hearth, illuminating from inside the whole of our St. Petersburg house. And only the noonday roar of the Petropavlovsk cannon could invade its quiet. Our relatives, non-entomological friends, the servants, and the meekly touchy Ivona Ivanovna talked of butterflies not as of something really existing, but as of a certain attribute of my father, which existed only in so far as he existed, or as of an ailment with which everybody had long since got used to coping, so that with us, entomology turned into some sort of routinary hallucination, like a harmless domestic ghost that sits down, no longer surprising anyone, every evening by the fireside. At the same time, none of our countless uncles and aunts took any interest in his science and had hardly even read his popular work, read and reread by dozens of thousands of cultured Russians. Of course, Tanya and I had learned to appreciate Father from earliest childhood, and he seemed even more enchanting to us than, say, that Harold about whom he told stories to us. Harold who fought with the lions in the Byzantine arena, who pursued brigands in Syria, bathed in the Jordan, took 80 fortresses by storm in Africa, the Blue Land, saved the Icelanders from starvation, and was famed from Norway to Sicily, from Yorkshire to Novgorod. Then, when I fell under the spell of butterflies, something unfolded in my soul, and I relived all my father's journeys, as if I myself had made them. In my dreams, I saw the winding road, the caravan, the many-hued mountains, and envied my father madly, agonizingly, to the point of tears, hot and violent tears that would suddenly gush out of me at table as we discussed his letters from the road, or even at the simple mention of a far, far place. Every year, with the approach of spring, before moving to the country, I would feel within me a pitiful fraction of what I would have felt before departing for Tibet. On the Nevsky Avenue, during the last days of March, when the wooden blocks of the spacious street pavements gleamed dark blue from the damp and the sun, one might see, flying high over the carriages, along the facades of the houses, past the city hall, past the lindens in the square, past the statue of Catherine, the first yellow butterfly. In the classroom, the large window was open. Sparrows perched on the windowsill, and teachers let lessons go by, leaving in their stead squares of blue sky, with footballs falling down out of the blueness. For some reason, I always had bad marks in geography, and what an expression our geography teacher would have when he used to mention my father's name. How the inquisitive eyes of my comrades turned on me at this point, and how within me the blood rose and fell from suppressed rapture and from fear of expressing that rapture. And now I think of how little I know, how easy it is for me to make some idiotic blunder in describing my father's researches. At the beginning of April, to open the season, the members of the Russian Entomological Society used to make a traditional trip to the other side of Black River, in a suburb of St. Petersburg, where in a birch grove which was still naked and wet, still showing patches of holy snow, there occurred on the trunks, its feeble transparent wings pressed flat against the papery bark, our favorite rarity, a specialty of the province. Once or twice they took me with them, too. Among these elderly family men, cautiously, tensely practicing sorcery in an April wood, there was an old theater critic, a gynecologist, a professor of international law, and a general. For some reason, I can recall especially clearly the figure of this general, X.B. Lambofsky. There was something paschal about him. his fat back bending low, with one arm placed behind it, next to the figure of my father, which sunk on his haunches with a kind of oriental ease. Both were carefully examining, in search of pupae, a handful of reddish earth dug up with a trowel. And even to this day, I'm wondering what the coachman waiting on the road made of all this. Sometimes in the country, grandmother would sail into our schoolroom. Olga Ivanovna Vyazhin, plump, fresh-complexioned, in mittens and lace. "Bonjour, les enfants," she would sing out sonorously. And then, heavily accenting the prepositions, she informed us, "Je viens de voir dans le jardin, près du cèdre, sur une rose, un papillon de toute beauté. Il était bleu, vert, pourpre, doré, et grand comme ça." "Quickly, take your net," she continued, turning to me, "and go into the garden. Perhaps you can still catch it." And she sailed out, completely oblivious to the fact that if such a fabulous insect were to come my way, it was not even worth a guess as to what banal garden visitor her imagination had so adorned, I would have died of heartbreak. Sometimes, to give me special pleasure, our French governess would choose a certain fable of Florian's for me to learn by heart about another impossibly gaudy petit maître butterfly. Sometimes some aunt or other would give me a book by Fabre, whose popular works full of chit-chat, inaccurate observations, and downright mistakes my father treated with scorn. I also remember this. One day, upon missing my net, I went out to look for it on the veranda, and met my uncle's orderly returning from somewhere with it on his shoulder, all flushed and with a kindly and shy smile on his rosy lips. "Just see what I've caught for you," he proclaimed in a satisfied voice, dumping the net on the floor. The mesh was secured near the frame by a bit of string, so that a bag was formed, in which a variety of live matter swarmed and rustled. And good heavens, what rubbish there was in it! 30-odd grasshoppers, the head of a daisy, a couple of dragonflies, ears of wheat, some sand, a cabbage butterfly crushed out of all recognition, and finally an edible toadstool noticed on the way and added just in case. The Russian common people know and love their country's nature. How many jeers, how many conjectures and questions have I had occasion to hear when, overcoming my embarrassment, I walked through the village with my net. "Well, that's nothing," said my father. "You should have seen the faces of the Chinese when I was collecting once on some holy mountain, or the look the progressive schoolmistress in a vulgar town gave me when I explained to her what I was doing in that ravine." How to describe the bliss of our walks with father through the woods, the fields, and the peat bogs, or the constant summer thought of him if he was away, the eternal dream of making some discovery and of meeting him with this discovery? How to describe the feeling I experienced when he showed me all the spots where in his own childhood he had caught this and that? The beam of a half-rotted little bridge where he had caught his first peacock butterfly in 71. The slope of the road down to the river where he had once fallen on his knees, weeping and praying. He had bungled his stroke. It had flown forever. And what fascination there was in his words, in the kind of special fluency and grace of his style when he spoke about his subject. What affectionate precision in the movements of his fingers turning the screw of a spreading board or a microscope. What a truly enchanting world was unfolded in his lessons. Yes, I know this is not the way to write. These exclamations won't take me very deep. But my pen is not yet accustomed to following the outlines of his image, and I myself abominate these accessory curlicues. Oh, don't look at me, my childhood, with such big, frightened eyes. The sweetness of the lessons. On a warm evening, he would take me to a certain small pond to watch the aspen hawk moth swing over the very water, dipping in at the tip of its body. He showed me how to prepare genital armatures to determine species which were externally indistinguishable. With a special smile, he brought to my attention the black ringlet butterflies in our park, which with mysterious and elegant unexpectedness appeared only in even years. He mixed beer with treacle for me on a dreadfully cold, dreadfully rainy autumn night in order to catch at the smeared tree trunks that glistened in the light of a kerosene lamp, a multitude of large banded moths silently diving and hurrying toward the bait. He variously warmed and cooled the golden chrysalids of my tortoise shells so that I was able to get from them Corsican, Arctic, and entirely unusual forms, looking as if they had been dipped in tar and had silky fuzz sticking to them. He taught me how to take apart an anthill and find the caterpillar of a blue which had concluded a barbaric pact with its inhabitants. And I saw how an ant, greedily tickling the hind segment of that caterpillar's clumsy, slug-like little body, forced it to excrete a drop of intoxicant juice, which it swallowed immediately. In compensation, it offered its own larvae as food. It was as if cows gave us chartreuse, and we gave them our infants to eat. But the strong caterpillar of one exotic species of blue will not stoop to this exchange, brazenly devouring the infant ants and then turning into an impenetrable chrysalis, which finally, at the time of hatching, is surrounded by ants, those failures in the school of experience, awaiting the emergence of the helplessly crumpled butterfly in order to attack it. They attack, and nevertheless, she does not perish. "I have never laughed so much," said my father, "as when I realized that nature had supplied her with a sticky substance which caused the feelers and feet of those zealous ants to get stuck together so that they rolled and writhed all around her, while she herself, calm and invulnerable, let her wings strengthen and dry." He told me about the odors of butterflies, musk and vanilla, about the voices of butterflies, about the piercing sound given out by the monstrous caterpillar of a Malayan hawk moth, an improvement on the mouse-like squeak of our death's head moth, about the small resonant tympanum of certain tiger moths, about the cunning butterfly in the Brazilian forest which imitates the whir of a local bird. He told me about the incredible artistic wit of mimetic disguise, which was not explainable by the struggle for existence, the rough haste of evolution's unskilled forces,